The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Smith, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
And attorneys, as you know, the rules of appellate court procedure remain in place, even though you are proceeding in this virtual platform. Each of you will have 15 minutes to state your case, your primary case. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal to appellate counsel if you wish to exercise that. And I need to remind you, for our purposes of recording, we need to have you state your name as well as which client you're speaking on behalf of before you begin making your statement. I'm now going to ask our marshal to call the case for consideration that we are hearing by Zoom. Oh, excuse me, everyone. I neglected to say there's only two judges that are on the screen. We do have an absent judge. Judge Wheelock is not participating at the Judicial Center today. However, she will be fully apprised as far as these proceedings because of our recording mechanism. This will not in any way delay any issuance of the decision of this court, which is within the 90-day timeframe. Has the case been called?
This case is A22-0269, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Richard James Graff, Appellant.
Appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent Richard Graff, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Graff raised three issues for this court's consideration, but I'm going to focus today on the first, which is whether the state failed to prove the element of venue beyond a reasonable doubt. Because the answer to that question is yes, this court must reverse his conviction. For Mr. Graff's conviction to stand, there must be sufficient evidence in the record, in the trial record, showing that the alleged events happened in Kandy, Ojai County. Now, the only evidence that the state offered of the specific location of Mr. Graff's home, which is where the offense allegedly occurred, is a generic numerical address of 301 14th Street Southwest. Now, that on its own is rather obviously not enough, because 14th Street could be found and probably is found in any county within the state of Minnesota.
Well, I would definitely agree with you on that point. I mean, as a trial judge, it used to happen quite a bit where the prosecution would fail to have the correct venue or the county of occurrence. But can't the jury make reasonable inferences? And the fact that a police officer was there and testified that he was on duty in or with the Wilmer Police Department, I think it was Wilmer Police Department, and then responded to the call. Don't they have the ability to infer that then this is the correct county of venue?
Arguably, they can make that inference, but this court doesn't defer to the jury's choice between reasonable inferences. Because the state proved venue by circumstantial evidence, this court applies the heightened standard review for circumstantial evidence. And so the state needed to show that its evidence inevitably and exclusively led to the conclusion that this offense happened in Kandy, Ojai County, and that didn't happen here. The last time this court considered this question was in the unpublished decision in State v. Brown, and this court decided that that wasn't enough. And I know that State v. Brown is unpublished and not binding on this court, but it's persuasive authority precisely because it's so factually similar to this case.
Is that the Target case?
That's the Target case.
Yeah, that seems so different to me because they're responding to the victim's home. But here, I mean, I was wondering, I mean, you've seen them, no doubt, our circumstantial evidence review cases where we say, you know, we don't, I should have the language at my fingertips, but basically conjecture and speculation aren't a reasonable, you can't find a reasonable inference of innocence based on that. It seems like if you have Wilmer police responding to an address, that the jury would have to infer, oh, they might have like some sort of like interjurisdictional agreement or something. And that's why the Wilmer police would be going to a non-Wilmer address. Why isn't that just sort of conjectural? Why else would Wilmer police be responding to an address?
I don't think it is conjecture, Your Honor. This court's decision in Brown, and I think respondents' reading of this court's decision in Brown, is that there are some circumstances under which a police officer would investigate an offense that occurred outside his jurisdiction. Maybe it's the case that the only circumstances where that happens is when a victim of an offense that occurred outside the jurisdiction lives within the jurisdiction. But the state just didn't present enough evidence here to prove that that was the case. If that's a distinction that makes a difference, I don't have enough information to tell you why, and neither did the jury in either of these cases. It was the state's job here to prove that their evidence that the Willmar Police Department investigated leads inevitably to the conclusion that the offense occurred in Willmar. And I think it's not conjecture to say that occasionally, or even frequently, I don't know, this kind of thing happens. I mean, Willmar is in Kaneohe County, which is part of the 8th Judicial District. There are 12 other counties within that judicial district. I don't know enough about police jurisdictional lines to tell you how they work, and neither do juries. Police jurisdictional lines are like targets. We don't know where they are unless the state tells us. And they didn't in this case.
In Brown, the police were responding to a call from the victim at her. Was it in Crystal? Is that where she lived?
It's unclear where she lived. All we know is that that a Crystal police officer responded and interviewed her at her home.
At her home. Oh, I see. But the case doesn't tell us that it was they were responding, that it was the police within her town or jurisdiction that were responding to her.
Michelle, yeah. This is, I hadn't even thought of this until listening to the argument now, but could you or trial counsel, because the jury goes out, couldn't you move for a directed verdict of acquittal? A verdict of acquittal?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that would have been appropriate here.
Because does the fact that that was not requested impact this case at all?
I don't think so. I think there's not sufficient evidence in the record. I think probably there should have been a motion for a directed verdict. There wasn't, or a motion for acquittal. But it remains the case that there's just not enough evidence in the trial record here to lead to the conclusion that this offense absolutely happened in Kaneohe County beyond a reasonable doubt. So unless there are other questions on this issue, I can move on to my second, which is the prosecutorial misconduct. And I know in this case, we have alleged multiple instances. And I think that is important to keep in mind that here in this case, just in closing argument, the prosecutor misstated the law, misstated the facts, and did both of those things in ways that were inflammatory. And I led with the issue of the narrative of dangerousness. And here, the prosecutor heard the police testimony about why they responded to Mr. Graff's residence, why they approached him, why they applied for a search warrant, and she overlaid and superimposed her own narrative about why that happened. And that's a mischaracterization of the record. That's not what happened. And in fact, because the violation of the HRO and the threats of violence charges were dismissed prior to, or rather the defendant's motion for acquittal was granted prior to the closing argument, it was also irrelevant. That information was not irrelevant to the remaining charges, which were assault against a police officer, fifth degree assault, and obstruction of justice. And so that only increases the inflammatory content of those statements, which, as we argued, are not based on the record. And that's also true with the information about the harassment restraining order, that the prosecutor claimed that the existence of the harassment restraining order meant that a prior judge had found that Graff was enough of a threat to SV that a restraining order had to be in place. And that's just not true, and it's not a reasonable inference from the record. If the state wanted to present that information to the jury, it had a chance to do so. And it didn't. So it can't make guesses about what the circumstances surrounding the restraining order are and make guesses that are harmful to Mr. Graff. Oh, I'm sorry. And those errors, and then the final misstatement of fact was that the prosecutor told the jury here that SV testified that she lived in Willmar. And I think that even if it's not the most egregious misstatement, it's certainly the most prejudicial, because here That's the very element that we're that the state failed to prove. And her misstatement.
Does that need to be intentional?
So I think perhaps it could have been raised as prosecutorial error rather than misconduct. I guess I don't disagree with the state that there's no evidence here that it was intentional, but it still was wrong. And it was very prejudicial because that was the very element that the state failed to prove. And this court's case law, the Minnesota Supreme Court case law, has said that even under prosecutorial error, reversal can be appropriate. And I think that's the case here. And I think particularly in view of all of the other errors, all the other instances of misconduct. Paraphrasing the Minnesota Supreme Court, this court just can't be confident looking at the trial record that the jury was able to focus on the issues it was supposed to focus on. Because it was told facts that were not true. It was told law that was not true. And any prejudices the jury might have had were activated by all of this talk of danger and not only a sort of, like I said, superimposed narrative of the way the police thought about SB and thought about Graff, but also figures like two different judges, the judge who signed the search warrant and the judge who issued the harassment restraining order. Under the prosecutor's telling of those events, they believed her, they thought he was a threat, they thought he was a danger. And that is highly prejudicial because by the time all of this information, this narrative is fed to the jury, it's very difficult for a defendant to counter that. It's not like a factual assertion where you can say, no, actually that's not what happened. You have to be able to say, oh, she painted me as a dangerous person, but I'm not. And I don't think that's very effective when the prosecutor calls him dangerous 12 different times, and especially in relation to evidence that was no longer relevant to the charges that were being submitted to the jury. And then on top of the misstatements of fact, we have the misstatements of law. So the prosecutor appears to tell the jury that intent is not, that it doesn't matter that there was no evidence of intent. And I understand that she did point to the circumstances around the alleged offense, but she didn't say, you can infer from these circumstances that he intended to assault Officer Athman. She said, it doesn't matter, and that you just can't punch somebody. that's lowering the state's burden to prove all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And then it also feeds into the second misstatement of law, which is the mischaracterization of the role of the jury, which was essentially encouraging the jury to say, you decide whether it was okay for Mr. Graff to punch that poor police officer. And that's just simply not the jury's job. And I think it's important to keep in mind here that the law is easy for lawyers. These aspects of the law are easy for lawyers, but they're not for the jury. And that's why we have these very careful jury instructions. And misstatements like this, they're subtle, and they, we can recognize the ways in which they conflict with the jury instructions, but like the jury is trying very hard to follow the rules here, and they're being misled, both in terms of the facts and in terms of the law. They're being told that if you think this was not okay, that's when you convict. So, and then the third issue, which I think connects with all of the prosecutorial misconduct instances, and that's why we raise cumulative error, because I think all of these errors create a perfect storm where we just can't be confident that the jury was focusing on the right questions. And so the fact that SB testified that she and Graff used drugs together, it's not relevant to, it's particularly not relevant to any of the offenses that were submitted to the jury, the charges that were submitted to the jury. But it also wasn't relevant to the charges that she was testifying about. There's no permissible probative value
So how does that work when it was just offered by her, not in response to a question? I don't think the prosecutor, unless you think the prosecutor elicited that testimony, but it didn't seem so. I mean, your underlying premise is the district court should have interrupted at that time and told the jury to ignore that. And that was a clear, plain error by the district court not to do that.
Yes, Your Honor. And the prosecutor does have a duty to prepare their witnesses. And I understand that that might have been more difficult in this case, but it was the prosecutor's duty to prepare witnesses, not to testify to anything inadmissible. And it was the judge's duty to step in when highly irrelevant and prejudicial evidence was offered at trial. I see that my time is running out. So unless this court has any additional questions, I will save the rest for rebuttal. We ask this court to reverse Mr. Graff's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. And we'll turn to respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Juliana Passy. I'm an assistant Canyon County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota. I would like to thank the court for their prompt attention to my last minute Zoom request due to the weather and counsel for their courtesy. Your Honors, Mr. Graff was found guilty after a fair and adversarial trial. He has identified no grounds for reversing the conviction, and the state requests that the court affirm. As to the venue issue, it's determined under the Kerrigan case cited in my brief, determined by all the reasonable inferences arising from the totality of the surrounding circumstances. I think this case is very dissimilar from the Brown, the Target case cited by the defense or the appellant in many ways. Here we have a street address. I agree it's not a particularly distinctive street address, but we have the Wilmer police officers. The testimony is that they're the officers. They're in uniform, they're on duty, they're in uniform, they're driving marked squad cars, and they're responding to a call to service at that address. I think what's an additional fact that is important in this case is that there are no allegations of any other law enforcement agencies responding to the address. This isn't some kind of multi-agency response where the sheriff's office is there and the police department is there and there's other police departments there. There's one police department there, three officers, Officer Flatten, Officer Athman, and Sergeant Livinggood, and they're all Wilmer police officers. So I think this is very dissimilar from the Brown case, which of course is unpublished on its own, but we have the officers responding to the address. Brown, we don't even know. All you know in the Brown case is that the assault occurred in a Target parking lot. Here, the Wilmer, the police officers who respond to the scene are Officer Athman is the victim of the crime. So I think this is very distinguishable from the Brown case. I think the court can easily set that one aside and rule that there's enough evidence here to proceed based on the street address and the on-duty officers responding to a call for service at that address.
I'm surprised that neither attorney has argued the impact of State versus Johnson, which is a Waseca County case. In fact, I was on the panel that made that decision, nothing to do with my former role in Waseca County, but I find that to be very much the same, where the officer responded and it was this court said that the jury could infer that, in fact, Waseca County was the venue when the officer was a Waseca police officer.
Yes, Your Honor, I did review that case briefly, and it was a while ago, so I've forgot a bit about it, but I do did review that case, and I do believe it's also on point and in line
easier to remember cases that we were a part of, so yeah.
That is true, but I think that case is in line with the Trezona decision and the Larson decision, which of course were cited in my brief because they were cases at the time I was writing the brief. But I think that's, it's all on point. I think the case law, I think this is, I of course agree that this, it could have been much better. This is an easy element, and I'm sure if the prosecutor could redo it, we would definitely have Canyon County, but I think there's enough on the record before the court to affirm on the venue issue. So then I think next turning to the closing argument issue, the graph is dangerous argument. I think that's a fair argument to make in this particular case. You know, it doesn't have to be a colorless argument by the prosecutor. I think the argument that Mr. Graff was dangerous was based on record evidence in this case and was in response to the line of defense pursued by Mr. Graff and his counsel at trial, which was essentially he's law enforcement is acting unreasonably in entering his residence in the manner that they did. They have guns drawn and tasers out. And I was surprised. I was taken aback and I acted involuntarily in punching this officer in the face. That's the defense that they're bringing. That's the story the jury is getting from the very beginning, from opening statements, from the defense. I think in the light of that and the record evidence that comes in, it is fair for the and not unduly prejudicial in any manner for the state to argue the opposite, that Mr. Graff did pose a danger and that there were reasons why the officers took the actions that they did in this case. Certainly there is the HRO, of course, is was at one point directly relevant. And then when SB's testimony wasn't what was expected to be, it became less of a, it didn't go back to the jury, but regardless, that's something that the jury heard about. That's because that's what the prosecutor of the state was trying to prove. We have the HRO that they actually, it was admitted into evidence. I believe it was published to the jury that there was some ongoing contact and ongoing conflict between SB and Mr. Graff. And that's why law enforcement were there at the time. SB does say she, and her testimony is admittedly a bit confused, I think, due to her mental illness, I think would be a fair inference. But she does say that she was concerned about conflict and she was concerned about being physically harmed. And then there's Mr. Graff's own actions when law enforcement goes to talk to him. They are, he's refusing to cooperate. He doesn't come outside the door to talk to law enforcement officers. He's moving within the house and he's yelling accusations through the door about SB at the officers. And this is occurring it's not a 5-minute occurrence. This is occurring for approximately an hour as law enforcement gets the search warrant. They prepare to enter the house. Mr. Graff is still not cooperative. They hear movement in the house, so they have concerns about what could be happening. And this is all directly relevant evidence to come in about why the police officers enter the house in the way they do. So I don't think there's any error, much less error that is a plain and obvious or clear error by the prosecutor in making that argument that Mr. Graff posed a danger to SB and potentially to the officers in his actions that day. The defense on the appellant makes several arguments about misstatements of the prosecutor as to the misstatements of the law on the role of the jury, by saying, you know, it's true that the prosecutor says it's up to you to decide whether it's perfectly okay for Mr. Graff to punch that young officer. But again, the case law says we have to consider these in context. This is directly immediately before making that statement, the prosecutor's arguing about the circumstantial evidence, including Graff knowing for an hour that the officers were going to enter the house, they wanted to speak with him, the punch. This is, again, has to be considered in context of the direct response to the arguments that defense counsel is making, that, oh, Mr. Graff didn't know, he was shocked, he was surprised, this was an involuntary reaction. So I think read in context, that is not error. And just turning briefly to substantial rights, Mr. Graff, there is no, this case, the alleged errors in this case certainly did not affect Mr. Graff's substantial rights. There was significant evidence in this case and overwhelming evidence of guilt. The only real element that was contested at trial was whether or not Mr. Graff intentionally punched the officer. There were two police officers who were on scene at that time who witnessed the punch, one who got punched and the other one who witnessed the punch. They both testified consistently that Mr. Graff appeared to be in control of his limbs at the time, that he had been hostile towards officers before they entered the house, and that I think most importantly, after he allegedly punched, or after he punched Officer Athman, he then continues to fight with officers when they're trying to restrain him. He makes statements like, come on, let's go, which Officer Athman testified, described as challenging the officers to continue to fight. He said sorry for punching the officer. He was not compliant at any point. And in fact, the Exhibit 2, which is the body cam video from one of the officers, demonstrates Mr. Graff's obstructive behavior that continued. The jury clearly credited that testimony, or that that evidence, because they also found him guilty of the lesser included charge of obstructing legal process. Mr. Graff had the opportunity to respond to most of the alleged prosecutorial misconduct in his closing statements, and in fact he did. And of course we have proper jury instructions from the judge in this case on the proper burden of proof and the correct law on assault. So I think all of in all of that, I think this, even if the court were to find error in any of this, of the state's the prosecutor's statements, certainly the state can establish that any error had no effect on Mr. Graff's substantial rights. As submission of SB allegedly referring to using methamphetamine with Mr. Graff, again, this is, I think it's pretty clear from the transcript, this was not elicited in any way by the prosecutor. And quite frankly, it's not even very, her testimony is not very clear as to that she was for sure saying that she used meth with Mr. Graff. It's her testimony is overall, I think is pretty vague. And the district court in fact did stop SB when she went off and started talking about drugs. So I think, I don't think there's plain error in that. And in any event, it was a vague statement that was dealt with pretty quickly and then moved on for. So unless the court has any further questions, I would simply ask that this court affirm Mr. Graff's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Posse. And Ms. Schultz, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. On rebuttal, I have a few comments, but I want to briefly address this court's decision in State v. Johnson. So I think Johnson is wholly distinguishable and actually good for Mr. Graff. I think the reason it's good for Mr. Graff is that it shows that when venue is proved by circumstantial evidence, this court applies the circumstantial evidence test. I think that is well established. The reason it's distinguishable is that the issue in that case wasn't whether the identity of the police department that investigated the offense necessarily led to venue. The question was, where was the police officer when he received the false report? This court decided that venue would be appropriate either where the report was made or where it was received. It was tried in Waseca County, and the police officer must have been there at the time he received it. And so there's evidence in the record that the police officer said, bring the child to me at Waseca Police Department. He made multiple statements indicating that he was at or very near the police station, which was in Waseca County. And this court determined that that made venue appropriate. So I think in terms of the amount of evidence presented by the state in that case versus this one is very different. Here, we only have the identity of the police department that investigated the offense. And in fact, we only have the identity of two of the three police officers who investigated the offense. I didn't see any evidence in the record that Officer Flatten was necessarily employed by the police department. And I do want to repeat that I don't think it is the only obvious conclusion that police officers only ever investigate offenses within their jurisdiction and that their jurisdiction is necessarily within the county. And I think that particularly makes sense in the case of Kandy, Ojai County, which is in a much larger judicial district. We've got 12 other counties. I don't know how jurisdiction works in those within a large judicial district. Is there cross-departmental cooperation? I think this court assumed that there was in Brown, and certainly that's how respondent reads Brown, is that there are some circumstances under which police officers are involved investigating offenses that happen outside their jurisdiction. And it was the state's job to prove that the evidence that they presented, which is just the identity of the police, leads to the only conclusion that it happened within Kaneohe County. And I don't think that happened here. I guess it leads to the next. Respondent pointed to State v. Kerrigan, that suggests that the standard for proving venue is inferences from the totality of the circumstances. And I think in light of Johnson, which clearly applied the circumstantial evidence test to the element of venue, and also just the fact that I think that language describes the circumstantial evidence test, that when an element is proved by circumstantial evidence, the jury makes inferences, but this court does not defer to the jury's choice between reasonable inferences. And here there is a remaining reasonable inference, which is that the police officers were responding to an offense that happened outside of Kaneohe County. So for that reason, Mr. Graff's conviction cannot stand. I want to briefly address the idea that Mr. Graff was a danger to SB. And I want to point out that that's not really the question. I mean, I certainly disagree that there's evidence in the record that he was a danger to SB, but that's not what the prosecutor said. The prosecutor didn't say, look at all this evidence, you know, and then concluded he is dangerous. What she said is she pointed to the police officer's testimony and said that they said, or she gave an explanation as to why they were doing what they were doing, and that it was a concern for SB that was animating their investigation of the offense, the fact that they got a search warrant, and then similarly on the HRO, that she said, this is what this means. And none of that was based on the record. And that's misconduct. You can't make up things or superimpose a narrative when we have witness testimony explaining their actions. And I see my time is running out, but we ask this court to reverse Mr. Graff's conviction.
Thank you. And I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments. They are helpful in our decision-making process. The matters are under advisement. We will issue a decision within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That does conclude our Zoom hearing. This court will stand in recess.